Coming up next on Tech News Today, social networks were unknowingly feeding information to intelligence agencies during the protests in Baltimore and Ferguson. We'll talk about that. Also, Amazon might be interested in jumping into the grocery store game. The long-term ramifications of Samsung's PR nightmare that is the Note 7. A look at Ada Lovelace's effect on women in STEM. And emojis get a movie, sad face. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1617, recorded Tuesday, October 11th, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Jira Service Desk from Atlassian. Jira Service Desk delivers everything your IT team needs out of the box at a cost-effective price. For a free trial of Jira Service Desk, visit Atlassian.com/twit.
And by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/twit.
And by LinkedIn Learning. Develop talent and keep skills current with expert-led on-demand e-learning. To request a demo for your organization or get a free individual trial, visit learning.linkedin.com/twit. Welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about everything you need to know about technology that happened today with people who are passionate about technology. I am Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. People who are used to talking about technology, possibly even on a daily recurrence, a daily schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Joining us today is a name you are already familiar with, Mr. Tom Merritt. How you doing, Tom?
I am passion fruit about technology, Jason.
Delicious? I don't know about
so that. Delicious.
Yes.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
It's always a pleasure to get you on, man.
Yes. And so people, maybe there's one, maybe there's two and a half people who've never heard of you. Tell everyone what you do.
I do a show called Daily Tech News Show, which sort of explains itself, as well as a show called Daily Tech Headlines. So Daily Tech News Show is a conversation show. We try to look at the issues of the day, put things in context for people, help to understand. Like today we had someone on talking about smart homes and security, or I'm sorry, smart cities and security. And then Daily Tech Headlines is just less than 10 minutes, all the top headlines of the day.
Awesome. Yeah, why have just a smart home when you can have a whole smart city?
Seriously.
Yeah, no, there's like the Internet of Public Things is a new buzzword, apparently, that's trying to be coined.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about, and I have a really good feeling that at least some of these things you've already talked about a little bit. So you're like all warmed up. We're starting fresh. Let's see where we go here. The American Civil Liberties Union published a blog post that details how Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram unknowingly fed data to 500 law enforcement agencies during the protests in Baltimore and Ferguson earlier this year. The data was originally granted to Geofedia. It's a social media analytics firm that collects information on users, including, in many cases, the location of those users. All three networks moved to stop or restrict the data transmission to Geofedia once they were aware of the ACLU's discovery. Now, the ACLU argues that discoveries like this produce a chilling effect for minority groups and those who wish to air their own political grievances publicly, and that companies like these should be doing more to protect free speech of activists. I guess Geofedia kind of captures this public information, then draws conclusions on users. A lot of this is, of course, for advertising purposes, as you know, a lot of times is the case here. I don't know. I think the tricky thing about this particular thing is so often we're warned about what we put out onto public forums. And I think, you know, possibly in aggregate, when you take 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different sources of public information and you sandwich them together, you can create some really interesting inferences about people when you combine that all. And I think that's kind of at the heart of what this is. What do you think about this, Tom?
Yeah, this is mostly a policy story, isn't it? Because the interesting thing is on the fringes of this, there's a little bit of confusion about exactly what information they might have been getting. And if they were getting private information, like email addresses, things that wouldn't be public, that makes this an entirely different conversation. But for the most part, what we know they were getting was public information, in which case all of Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter were doing was making it easier for them to take this information. I mean, if you don't think companies are already doing this about your social media posts without the cooperation of Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, you're fooling yourself. So the question is, should it be easier for them to work with these companies? Should Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter allow them access to the API when they are doing it for law enforcement purposes, for surveillance purposes, or not? And that's just that's a political question for these companies.
Well, I mean, if we're talking about Twitter and we've been talking like who's going to buy them, what are they worth? And really, like, it's all about the data. And, you know, they sell it to people. They say they have this longstanding rule about not letting companies use this data for surveillance. And then they, you know, they have said since this ACLU report came out, they've all, you know, Twitter and Facebook have cut off Geofedia's, you know, access to their hose, as it were. You know, it's just a rule. It's not a policy. And how do they know? I mean, if they're giving out this data, how do they know how people are using it?
Yeah, I think that's the big challenge. And the question that I have is, you know, Geofedia might have, you know, a history of doing this for advertisers, let's say, if that was kind of their named goal. So these companies have worked out a deal to pass along information to them. They've done that under the guise of it being for this one thing. Well, then, you know, let's say law enforcement or a government agency comes along and realizes that there's value to them as well. How do these social networks actually know or truly understand what's happening with that data after the fact? That seems to be kind of at the core here.
And it's all public data. This is not, again, there are a couple of questions that maybe there was some non-public data, and that becomes a different question. But if this is public data, it's being gathered about you by lots of people for lots of different reasons in larger amounts than just what Geofedia was doing. So, you know, it does shine a light on a larger problem of lots of people are seeing what you do online and aggregating it. And as you mentioned, Jason, they can deduce things about you by cross-referencing that with all kinds of other stuff. Even if you're not saying, you know, what race, religion, ethnicity, political persuasion you are, you know, they can figure that out by tracking you online. They don't even have to know your name.
And you don't even have to say anything necessarily, because a lot of time there's also a lot of metadata that's attached. You know, what phone were you using when you sent it? What was the, you know, what was the location? What was the cell tower? You know, all of this information is happening behind the scenes.
Did you guys take that Facebook together? That Facebook test where it said, we'll guess what political persuasion you are based on your posts?
No, but I'm interested, but slightly afraid of that.
Yeah. And it was almost Facebook demonstrating this, like, we can figure out a lot of things about you.
For sure.
Yeah. But then sometimes, you know, if you go into Facebook and look at like what they say they know about you, it's sometimes just bizarre and really has
maybe they know it about you. You just don't know it about you yet.
Maybe they know you better than you know yourself, exactly. Megan.
Well, I think they do. I do think they have that page set up so that it is. Like, they obviously know so much more, but they have this page where it's like, you like donkeys and kittens and Samsung Galaxy Note 7s, you know? Just
admit it. Admit it, Megan.
I do like
Here,
all those
I've
things.
I've got one if you want to use it.
No, I don't.
I'll keep it open.
Well, the tech world just became a little more legit. TechCrunch reports that the World Economic Forum announced a new tech hub in San Francisco to recognize technology's impact on the global economy and to update policies and regulations, some of which were written before the internet was invented. The office is called the Center for the Fourth Industrial Revolution. It's only the WEF's third satellite location outside of Davos, Switzerland. The others are in Beijing and New York. 60 staffers at the Center for the Fourth Industrial Revolution will focus on policy recommendations on new technologies and funding research. And in this new spot, they'll, of course, have better access to Silicon Valley startups, investors, and venture capitalists. I think we need this. We talk a lot about AI and self-driving cars and, you know, things like blockchain really disrupting not just economics, but the way we're living. Murat Somnaz, he was a former executive at TIBCO. He says this office will be less of a think tank and more of a do tank. What do you think, Tom?
I like the idea of that. People say stuff like that and you immediately want to roll your eyes and like, sure, it will. But really, like the idea of of someone actually executing on that is fantastic. And I agree with you that having a center where smart people can get together and try to work out the challenges that new technologies are causing ahead of time is a fantastic idea. So I don't want to be the naysayer that says, this is a bad thing. It does when they say things like do tank or the fourth industrial revolution. I mean, did we have three? Did I miss a couple? It seems a little pretentious, but underneath, if you peel back those layers, there's probably some good work being done.
Yeah, it's really all about kind of, especially right now, just the impressive pace of technology. Things are moving. I feel like just in this 1 year, and I know I've said it on the show probably a number of times at this point, but it's just one example, like artificial intelligence. I feel like at the beginning of this year, it was this neat little thing that companies were playing with. And now they're like betting the future of their company on it. And it has such far-reaching potential as it gets developed that you need conversations around this. Regulations need to be made smartly about these things to dictate and help to form what these develop into and grow into 10, 15 years down the line. If things have moved this fast in 1 year, then it's super important to have these discussions now to make sure that we're thinking about these things longer term. So I think that's great.
Yeah, I could do with a few fewer buzzwords. They took prosperity, sustainability, and inclusivity. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, do that. I like
yes,
that.
All those things, right? it's good that this is representatives of the actual industries, of academia, of government. And when you put, say, the FAA's reaction to quadcopters and UAVs next to the general government reaction to autonomous vehicles so far, you can see a couple of different ways that governments and regulatory agencies can react. In the FAA's case, they're still playing catch up. This is something that caught them unawares, and they haven't yet got ahead of it, although they're making some progress finally. Whereas the NHTSB and regulatory agencies in certain states, including California, are already saying, yes, we're going to put these regulations in place now. Some people think California is being too strict, but I think it's smart of them to say, well, let's be strict from the beginning so that we can ease up as we need to. But everybody's thinking about it now rather than just waiting for autonomous cars to be ready and then suddenly have the states grind their slow gears for years before we get them on the streets.
Yeah. Technology is moving too fast for that nowadays anyways. Amazon might have brick and mortar in its sights sometime in the near future. We've heard stories about this, the past couple of years. Well, a report on the Wall Street Journal indicates that the company is interested in opening not only a large drive-up grocery store near its Seattle headquarters, but also smaller kind of convenience stores, which could sell perishable items, produce, meat, cheese, milk, that sort of stuff. Items not found in the store could be ordered from a customer's phone to be delivered later that day at home. According to the report, the convenience store idea is still more than a year off, could be scrapped entirely if it's determined to be a financial or an operational challenge. But they're calling it Project Como internally, and it would be available to Amazon Fresh subscribers. So they're already paying a fee. I think it's right now they just lowered it from $2.99 a year to $15 per month. I don't know. Does Amazon need to get into the brick and mortar game? What do you think, Tom?
Yeah, this is one that Patrick Beja and I definitely did talk about today. And it's fascinating to me because what it sounds like is Amazon, which does have brick and mortar locations for bookstores now in several locations throughout the United States, and they're slowly expanding that, is wondering if grocery stores would also benefit, or convenience stores in this case. And it sounds like, from what I read on the Wall Street Journal article, that they're going to have a drive-up location available in Seattle within the next couple weeks, just to test that idea of, instead of having it delivered to my house, what if I order it and then go pick it up on the way home? That's intriguing. And then also what you were saying about being able to be in the store and pick up perishable items, but then decide like, oh, you know what, I also need some peanut butter, and add that in as well while you're in the store. That all makes sense to me in a certain way. But we've seen so many people fail with trying to combine these in the past that I think it's smart for Amazon to try it. And I'm very curious what balance they're going to find between what is better online and what we actually do want to have available in a physical location. Because, the fears of, all the stores will go away because we can order things online. We're never realized. But certainly, you know, Circuit City can attest that some stores did go away. So what are the things we actually want physical locations for? And it seems like Amazon is working on that.
Yeah, I mean, one thing about this story that struck me is, like, the convenience stores are apparently not convenient enough for us.
Oh, man. I was just in Japan. They have convenience stores down. Our convenience stores have some work to do.
Inconvenience stores, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, what you're saying is true. It has to be easier to understand, because both of you had to, you know, go, it's okay, so it's for people that want to pick out their own peaches, but also people who get in a store and realize they want something else, also maybe more peanut butter. So, you know, it's a confusing premise to people, but I think if anyone can go forward with a confusing premise and just throw a bunch of stuff at the wall and see what sticks, it's Amazon, right? I mean, you know, they did the Fire Phone and they're still fine, even though that was a complete failure.
That dripped off, unfortunately.
Yeah. They, unlike Samsung, didn't do the Fire Phone.
That's true. It's probably a good thing it didn't work out that way for Amazon.
We need a pun-o-meter for Tom when he comes on.
A button to press for an instant rim shot.
Or a maximum that just cuts me off.
Yes, that's it. He's gone now. I mean, also just the fact that Amazon really would love to sell every single thing known to man, basically, at this point. Groceries are 20% of consumer spending, but only 2% of consumer spending online. So if it's going to... If they are going to capitalize off of this thing that we all shop for, apparently, maybe it behooves them to have some sort of brick and mortar store to do that, at least to test it out.
I don't think it'll be that confusing in the end if it's like you're ordering, right? And it says, here are your options. You can have it delivered, which means you have to be home, or it has to be left. And if it's perishable, do you really want it left on your doorstep? So you have to make sure you're home, or you can just pick it up. And if it's convenient and it's like on your way home from work, that is a better option in many cases, especially if you're getting milk and eggs.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I've tried those before and it's like, well, you have this window and that window. And then it just seems so much more complicated. Like, I don't know when I'm going to leave work. And when I leave work, I want to just go to the grocery store and pick out my own peaches.
Dang it.
It's all about the peaches.
Exactly. Well, in the U.S., 5 million households with children lack internet connections, and that is causing a homework gap. To that end, Sprint has announced that over the next 5 years, they will give 1 million free devices and free high-speed data plans to low-income students. Those involved with the program can choose a smartphone, a tablet, a laptop, or a hotspot device. Sprint says they'll work with students to determine the best device for them. Like most dealings with Sprint or other mobile carriers, it pays to read the fine print. In this case, it appears that the only the real fine print is just that it's a 3 gigabyte data cap, which is better than nothing and should be plenty if you use it just for homework. Sprint's 1 million project will be supported by donations from device manufacturers, partners, and funds raised through special events. So what do we think, Tom? Is this, do you have anything bad to say about Sprint's new service?
Not a thing. Sprint is amazing. I can hear them now. Yeah. You know what this put me... I don't know if you guys talked about this previously, but Pew Research had a report last week showing that since 2013, the number of U.S. adults who used a smartphone as their connection, as their only net connection, rose from 8 to 13%. So it makes sense to me that a company like Sprint would say, hey, we see people dropping home internet connections, sometimes because of cost. Let's step in and provide a service that allows people to do what they're trying to do already with, in a lot of cases, just going with phones. It's good publicity for Sprint, obviously, to do that sort of thing. The idea that it's only a 3 gigabyte connection on a data limit is a little disappointing. And the idea that, I think, as you both know, that children will just limit it to homework is troubling, is difficult to enforce.
Mm-hmm. Definitely not Pokemon Go or whatever the latest Pokemon Go thing is, because I think that's already yesterday's news. I mean, obviously great news for students. Any way that you can close this gap is important. You know, some folks in chat are saying, you know, I went to school and I didn't, you know, need an internet connection and it worked out fine for me. That was then. Now, I mean, it's required. Like, at this point, so much of this stuff, like, it's essential. It pivots around access to technology. Not having that access can be a real kind of detriment to your education. That's just the reality of today. Sprint CEO Marcelo Claire Klar basically suggested that this is kind of a get them while they're young sort of strategy. You know, hopefully once they get older, they'll realize that they had this access early on, and that will influence their decision when it's time for them to pick their own plan down the line. And I think that's a smart move. It does make me wish, like, in light of, you know, we're going to talk about the Note 7 here in a few minutes, but in light of that, that more of this didn't happen around devices that are like Sprint had to, you know, create some good relationships in order to get these devices and everything. And I just wish we could take a lot of the devices that are still great, still useful, but not used by people, and do more of this. Because, I mean, otherwise that stuff just fills landfills. Of course, don't do that with the Note 7, because that's a bad idea. But I'm just saying, I would love to see more of this with unused devices. But there we go. Google's Project Fi wireless service is now becoming somewhat more economical with its new family plan, something it has lacked since it launched last summer. The new plan allows for the addition of up to 5 lines for $15 per month each. That's $5 less than the base price. Beyond that, the data cost is unchanged. That's $10 per gigabyte of data. The Google Fi app allows for managing the members attached to the account by allowing the owner to do things like set quotas for data usage, that sort of stuff, making it very useful for families. Google also, strangely, because usually when you hear about family plans, you just think of them as like that. It's a family plan meant for you and your family. Google seems to include family and friends, so you could just get 5 of your buds and just throw them onto your account. Hopefully you stay, you know, good friends. But there you go. They're kind of opening it up. One other thing that I find interesting here is last week they removed the 5X and the 6P from the Google Store because of the Pixel announcement. You can still get them through Fi. So if you really want those devices, you're thinking about signing up for Fi, you can still find them there. The 6P is like $100 off. 5X is $150 off through Project Fi. What do you think? Is Project Fi still an obscurity, or are these moves that are meaningful for Google's bottom line with it?
I think this is a good thing for Fi. As to your question about being obscurity, kind of.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people who are very enthusiastic about it and spread the word, but I don't think most people know about it. On the other hand, this really wants to make me get my mom into Project Fi, because she can't get T-Mobile where she lives. It just doesn't have good coverage in her house, but she can get Verizon and Sprint. So if I can get her on Project Fi, obviously she'll be able to use that Sprint connection on Project Fi when she's home, and then she'll have the advantage of the T-Mobile connections when she's out and about. Right. And it's cheaper per gigabyte, and she uses a lot of data because she doesn't have Wi-Fi in her house. So I'm looking at this and thinking, yeah, I absolutely want to do this. And the other thing that people may not realize, and I only just recently learned this, you can take a Project Fi SIM card and put it in anything that is GSM capable. I put it in my iPhone 6. It works fine. The key is you have to buy one of the Nexus phones or a Pixel in order to start your account. So what I could do is order a Project Fi SIM card for my mom on my existing Project Fi account, which I have with my Nexus 5X, and then just pop it in her iPhone.
Nice.
I did not know that.
I had heard that there was some sort of mix, but I didn't know that it would work on all devices. But I mean, that makes sense. I mean,
I'm not going to promise it works on all devices, but I popped mine into my iPhone 6, and I was like, I'll be able to get data, but I won't be able to make calls. I was even able to make calls.
Nice.
So Burke is pointing out just, you know, some of the barrier is money, because you have to, I mean, these are not the least expensive Android phones, right? Like, I mean, yes, you get $100 off the 6P, $150 off the 5X, but they're not, I mean, they're kind of high-end phones. Obviously, the Pixel is a high-end phone also, right? So you're not, we just got done talking about the homework gap or whatever. Like, this is sort of the savings gap. Like, hey, if you can afford to get in on this plan and buy these sort of expensive Android phones, then you'll get savings. Like, this kind of particular savings that we would all like to roll over our data, our unused data. I mean, wouldn't we like that? It just makes sense. It's almost a crime, I feel like, that I'm just paying for the stuff that I'm not using, and then I try to change my plan, and then it's too little, and then I have to pay more. It just always feels like I'm being taken advantage of. And I have the luxury of, you know, once a month I call up Sprint, who is my carrier, and say, like, how can I pay less? And then I talk to them for a half an hour, 45 minutes. Everybody doesn't have that kind of time. It does feel like the barrier might be just financial.
Well, and Leo in chat, by the way, points out that when you do pop that SIM card in another phone, it only works on T-Mobile. It doesn't pick up Sprint or US Cellular anymore.
That's definitely a large asterisk.
So that's a drawback to that little plan.
For sure. But if you like the pricing, you know, the pricing structure of it, that could be. And yeah. I should also point out the 5X is actually a pretty inexpensive phone. It's like a couple hundred bucks.
And it's a nice phone. I actually like that fingerprint sensor on the back.
Yeah. So you've got options. You know, the 6P is 400, the 5X 200, Pixel 650. So they've got a little bit of a range at least if you're getting it through 5.
Burke says he somehow paid a lot more than that.
Sorry, Burke.
I don't know where he buys things. Well, with the Note 7 officially no longer in production, who will gain from Samsung's loss? Apple, Google, Huawei, we will discuss. But first, this episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Jira Service Desk from Atlassian. Are you tired of clunky support tools that are a pain to use? I am. You can modernize IT support with Jira Service Desk from Atlassian. Jira Service Desk is a new service management software that IT teams will love to use. It's built on the Jira platform. Jira Service Desk delivers everything your IT team needs out of the box at a cost-effective price. Jira Service Desk lets you give customers an easy way to ask for help. You can help your agents be productive, from just putting out fires to helping employees get all their stuff done. You can stay on top of service level agreements with dynamic queues and mobile alerts. How about repetitive tasks? Every business has repetitive tasks. You can automate them so your agents can focus on solving the important stuff. Jira Service Desk is simple to set up and so affordable, you will not even need to ask your boss's approval. Now, our engineering department at Twit uses Jira Service Desk in two different ways. For projects, they keep track of the state of the project and the tasks assigned to each project as the project moves from concept to implementation and then to tweaking the final product. And for general engineering tasks, they take advantage of Jira Service Desk's customization to track all kinds of engineering tasks and the progress made by assignees. For a free trial of Jira Service Desk, visit Atlassian.com/twit. The first 100 signups will receive a free t-shirt. See why over 20,000 IT teams love Jira Service Desk by trying it free today. That's Atlassian.com/twit. Go there, and we thank them for their support.
All right. It's official. Even more official than yesterday when we talked about Samsung's unofficial recall of all Note 7s. As of last night, Samsung said that the Note 7 will cease to be manufactured, ultimately marking an end to the device. Samsung rushed to get the phone out ahead of its competitors, we heard about, when all this battery stuff started happening. And in doing so, failed to catch critical details in how a higher capacity battery was sandwiched into a smaller compartment when you compare it to the previous Note 5. As Charles Arthur put it on his blog, Samsung succeeded at making the Note 7 waterproof. It failed at making it fireproof. Now people are looking towards the smartphone kind of landscape as we head into the holiday season to see who the biggest winners and the biggest losers are going to be. And I don't know, it just seemed like a good kind of discussion to have here. This is critical timing for Samsung. Obviously, this is going to impact them not only short term but long term. We've talked a lot about that in the past. What are options? What do you guys think as far as people's options are concerned? I mean, there's sticking with Android, and then there's moving beyond Android. Do you think a lot of people are going to be fed up with kind of Samsung in general and jump ship to the iPhone or other platforms? What do you think, Tom?
My guess is not many of them. Certainly some will, but I have a feeling that the folks who are passionate about the Note 7 tend to be on the more sophisticated end of using things. So I'm curious where they'll migrate. I don't have a good sense of that. I think a lot of them will just go to a Galaxy S7, even though that doesn't, you know, you may think, oh, they won't want to be burned by Samsung again, pun intended. But the Samsung Galaxy S7 has not had any problems. And the Note 7 users that I've talked to have actually been very loyal to the Note 7, even after the first recall. So they might be more likely to stick around and stay in that ecosystem. But there really isn't a great replacement for the Note at its size with that stylus, particularly. So they might try some Huawei, they might try some LG. Maybe some of them will go to the Pixel, but it sort of seems like it's a scattered number of options depending on what your priorities are.
Yeah, I mean, I think at first I thought, oh gosh, well, Apple's really going to win this one. But no, I think you're right that anyone who's really in the Android ecosystem is probably not going to switch. I think a lot of people who maybe were convinced to go into Android, like, just try this phone. You will love it. You will love it. It's got a camera better than the iPhone. You know, you just try it. You know, family members, I'm thinking like wives, daughters, those sorts of things, might have been convinced, but then they're just like, see, no, you know. So I think that But I think that there will be people that switch to the Pixel if they can wait. You know, I don't know how many more weeks they have to wait. But
well, I mean, there's the waiting factor, right? The Pixel is coming out at the end of the month, so there's a little bit of that. I think beyond that, the challenge with the Pixel, like Google, man. If Google had played this a little bit differently, and obviously Google was not going to be aware that the Note 7 was going to have the outcome that it did, but if they had made it so that they weren't quite as exclusive to just Verizon, excuse me, and selling on the site, and they were, you know, available in all carriers, like that would have painted a picture where Google could stand to really benefit, right? Google's a name that people recognize. This is their first series of devices that's made by them and considered premium, so definitely on the same kind of pricing structure, even if it doesn't match, you know, spec to spec as far as the features of the Note 7. If they were in all of these carrier stores when people came back to return their notes, that would really benefit Google and really drive sales, but they're not. They're just in Verizon. Otherwise, you have to buy it through their site. And even beyond that, who knows how many devices that they would have to, you know, to provide right out of the gate. Some of the numbers that Charles in his blog post was pulling up is that by his like back of the napkin math, it's somewhere around 3.3 million Pixels hitting sales channels by the end of the month. And you compare that to the expected 17 million Note 7s for the course of a year. Like, they're just very different numbers. So, you know, they possibly wouldn't even have the stock to keep up. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it's, you know, an apples to apples comparison. Google would love that, but I just don't think that.
No, it's an apples to Androids comparison.
That's right. True. That's true. Thank you.
Okay, so what about like the fact that, I mean, some people say that the Note 7 wasn't really supposed to be like, it wasn't supposed to be a super popular phone. It wasn't supposed to be like the phone that everyone needed. It was more of a like a brand. It was intended to just bring the whole Samsung brand, like rise, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats, all Samsung boats. Do you think that, God, we are crazy for the puns today. I mean, do you think now it's going to sink all of those boats? Because, I mean, do you think it's just besmirched the brand so much that, I mean, are people, you know, why wouldn't people just try a Note 5 or an S7?
I mean, yeah, the Note 5 is actually a great option. Mm-hmm. If you have a Note 5 you want to get rid of, now's the time to put it on eBay because you're going to get a lot of Note fans who want that. But yeah, it's a great point. You could have got the Huawei Mate 8 for cheaper. You definitely could have saved a lot of money with the OnePlus 3. So you had cheaper options out there, but there were Note fans, people who just liked that brand and were looking forward to this new version of it. And yeah, maybe that's a reason they'll go to the Pixel phone. I don't know that those fans will abandon Samsung, but Megan, you bring up the point, how many other people will avoid it just because? We mentioned earlier today that Chelsea Handler had a post on Twitter where she was making a political comparison with someone's campaign, but said, it's burning like a Samsung Galaxy 7. She mm-hmm. didn't say Note 7.
Right.
And maybe she knows the difference, but it's not what she wrote. And I think a lot of people are going to shorthand this to, yeah, it burns like a Samsung. And that's going to have an effect. That's going to have a slowing effect on sales. That said, Tesla had a burning battery issue a few years back, and we've forgotten all about it. Sony had a huge recall on batteries for laptops. And granted, Sony has gotten out of the laptop space, but I don't think that's why. We've kind of forgotten about that. Nobody looks at those laptops and says, oh, I'm not going to get a Vaio because it burns. They have other reasons for not getting a Vaio. So I think Samsung can weather this, but it's going to be difficult, and it's definitely going to have an impact.
Yeah, especially when you also consider like iPhone had its own, it had Bendgate, and you know, that was a big, by many people that was considered a pretty big deal at the time. And can the Apple brand, you know, weather this storm? And of course, obviously it did. So, but I do think that it has some sort of a short term and somewhat long term effect on Samsung, its ability to market its brand. Maybe not necessarily, and strangely saying this in this way, maybe not necessarily to the people that had a Note 7, because so many of those people, like you said, Tom, they were already kind of they're already sold on the Samsung experience and the Samsung brand. And so they might be more likely to be like, okay, well, this one doesn't work, but I'm like the Note 7 because I've liked Samsung and had good experiences with them thus far, so I'll try this other thing. It's the people who haven't yet. you know, the people who all they've heard about Samsung is they got on an airplane and heard that, you know, no one can fly with a Samsung phone. They don't even know what phone it is because they don't care enough to know what a Note 7 is. But that becomes a marketing, you know, challenge for those people who are unconvinced, and that could hurt them over the next couple of years. The Huawei comparison is interesting, not necessarily in the U.S., but more so for international presence, because Huawei is largely considered Samsung's kind of next competitor in many markets. This could be a very good opportunity in some of these markets outside of the U.S. where Huawei has a much stronger presence to kind of swoop in and capitalize short term. And they've been really pushing hard to create high quality devices at a, you know, less premium price, and they've done a really good job with that. So this could be a great opportunity for Huawei to sweep in and kind of gain something over Samsung.
So what about the people that refuse to give theirs up? Will they be able to keep using them? I mean, I know with the first recall, they, you know, you weren't allowed to charge them all the way up, yeah. But I haven't heard anything about that. I know you can't use it in the Gear VR, I guess, anymore, yeah. Which is great. You don't want to hold it that close to your face.
No, don't
really.
Do that.
But do you think that there will be people who are just like, I love this phone and I'm not giving it up. You can pry it from my cold, burned hands.
My very hot, burned, angry gray smoke. Filled hands. No, I think if Samsung's smart, they'll disable them.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing but liability on their hands if they don't.
Mm-hmm. And in their hands.
Yeah.
And I don't think they can kill them. There's no kill switch for it. But I think they can bring the functionality down to the point where they say, we've washed our hands of it. If you're using it, it's definitely on you. And you shouldn't. These are things that have proven pretty dangerous to have around.
Yeah.
But okay, so I mean, statistically speaking, is it more dangerous for me to walk around with that Samsung Note 7 or to get in my car and drive home?
Do you want
to? It's more dangerous to drive home. You shouldn't do that either.
Right. Okay, good to know. I'll just live here. But you know what I'm saying? It's like, it's one of those statistics. Okay. But I have to drive home.
Certainly.
I don't want to live here.
But we wouldn't be recalling the notes if this was an acceptable risk for phones.
Right. Right. Exactly. Right. Well, we got an email about this very topic from a viewer, Cliff from Alquippa, Pennsylvania. Cliff writes, my family has been Samsung mobile loyal. I have a Note 12.12 tablet. I just went from a Note 3 to a Note 7. My wife uses a Note 10, 10.1 tablet, and a Note 4. My daughter went from an S4 mini to a Note 5. Dang. I will no longer use a Samsung phone. It looks like Pixel XL for me. My daughter is going to go iPhone. My wife will probably follow me to the Pixel. So that's what I was saying. I mean, I didn't mean to be offensive when I said wives and daughters, as if, you know, women will only use iPhones. But I have, you know, I do know that it's cool to use an iPhone among the kids these days. And, you know, I had a Samsung S4 or S3. I can't even remember. I tried to give it to my daughter. She was like, what is this? Like, all our friends were like, what is this? You know,
there's no Apple on the back, Mom. What is
right.
this?
So it's, I wish it weren't that way, but it is a little bit of like a status symbol too. And so I can see families just, you know, saying, like, I tried your Samsung phone and, you know, I'm done with you.
Yeah. Coming up, we're going to chat about the important influence of Ada Lovelace with women and technology in today's tech world. But first, let's take a minute to thank ZipRecruiter. They are the sponsor of this episode. If you're hiring, you need to know where to post your job to find all the best candidates. And it's not easy. There are a ton of places online. You already know this. If you want to find the perfect hire, you're going to need to post your job on all of the top job sites. And thankfully, with ZipRecruiter, you can do that easily. Posting jobs in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. You want to reach them all. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to more than 100 job boards, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. You just post one time, and then from that post, you're going to watch your candidates roll into the ZipRecruiter easy-to-use interface. They make it really easy for you to kind of pick and choose, see, you know, who's qualified, who's listed there. ZipRecruiter offers optimized pages that look great on any screen. You can also add their unique mobile apply process for more visitors and more applicants. And obviously, you can find candidates in any city or any industry nationwide. So this is touching all over the map. No more juggling emails or calls to your office. It's easily manageable through the interface. You can actually add multiple users to your account to help you manage all that. quickly screen candidates with real-world questions using free-form, multiple-choice, or yes-no formats that you set up and you decide. You can view candidate responses in conjunction with their beautifully formatted resumes. You can rate them and, of course, hire the right person and fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 1 million businesses. More than 125 million candidate applications have been delivered. And right now, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. All you have to do is go to ZipRecruiter.com/twit. That's ZipRecruiter.com/twit. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today.
Happy Ada Lovelace Day, everyone. It's the second Tuesday in October, which means it's not only Patch Tuesday for Microsoft. It's also the day that we celebrate women in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. In honor of Ada Lovelace, joining us to talk about why we're still talking about Ada is Aaron Carson, reporter at CNET. Welcome, Aaron.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
So, as you correctly write, Ada Lovelace gets name-checked a lot. Talk a little bit about who she was.
Sure. So, Ada Lovelace was born in 1815. Her dad was the notable English poet, Lord Byron. And she's mostly known for her work with Charles Babbage, who was a mathematician, and primarily on his analytical engine. So what that was basically a proposed general purpose computer. So she wrote, or she translated an article about the analytical engine into Italian. And what kind of came out of that was that she had this incredible, not only a grasp on what the analytical engine was, but like what it could be in the future. So some of the ideas that she talked about, it's kind of like a shorthand, is like, you know that we don't have to use this just as a calculator, right? Like we can do a lot more with this than just crunch numbers. So one of the things that she was talking about, you know, was the idea that content, I guess as we would put it today, something like musical notation, for example, could be represented in a digital form and then manipulated by a computer. So in a lot of ways, she made this incredible conceptual leap to what we understand today as computers. And yet it was only the mid-1800s. So, yeah.
So there are a lot of forgotten females in technology. Who are some of the other ones that you talked about in your article?
Sure. So a really fascinating set is the six women who were the original like programmers of the ENIAC computer in the 40s, like 1946. And when the ENIAC sort of first debuted, they were completely left out of coverage, which is sort of sad. But later on, they're kind of finally getting some of their dues. And also, you know, as a lot of folks have probably heard, there's a book and a movie coming out called Hidden Figures, and that's about three women who are mathematicians for NASA and helped do the calculations that put John Glenn in orbit. And that's just a kind of another case of you sort of step back and go like, wait, how am I just hearing about this? So it's a long track record.
So, Tom, I know we've known each other for a while, and you've been following tech history. You know, post about it, you talk about it. Has Ada Lovelace always been there for you, or is her name popping up more recently?
Oh, yeah. She's been there for a long time for me as somebody who's been interested in tech history, as you know, someone who is widely credited with writing the first computer program, even if it couldn't be executed. You know, June 5th and December 10th are other important dates around her. June 5th is when she met Mr. Babbage in question. And of course, December 10th that Aaron talked about. So she is important, but I believe she is getting more attention over time as people look for female role models for tech and STEM in general.
And do you think that we, I'll start with you, Aaron, and I'll ask this question. Do you think that we are giving her more credit at this point than she really deserves? Or do you think that she was just forgotten so long and that's why we are making more of her now? Or do you think it's a little bit of both?
You know, I think that's one of those things that's kind of hard to say. There was this huge revival for Babbage in the 80s, in the 90s, in terms of interest. And so you had these like two schools of thought that kind of emerged. And one was really sort of heavy on saying like, yes, she was this phenomenal visionary. And, you know, the other one was kind of like, she didn't do much. Like Tom said, like, she didn't really have anything to program at the time, you know. But I think that it's, you know, worth noting that she wouldn't be the first historical figure that gets credit for her thoughts, her big ideas, you know. And these days, she's, you know, lending her name and her face to the women in tech movement. And also, you know, like Tom mentioned, kind of that need in the industry for women to have role models. So at this point, she's almost becoming something more, if that makes sense, you know.
For sure. And I mean, you know, this theme has, I mean, since we've started doing this show, especially, we've seen this kind of this theme of the tech industry really kind of trying to put mechanisms into place to kind of level the playing field to a certain degree, make sure that, you know, that the technology space is inclusive on all sorts of ways and, you know, gains that perspective of, let's say, you know, women in tech or, you know, whoever, everyone basically, so that the tech is formed around everybody's image. So the Ada Lovelace Day was first introduced 8 years ago. I guess my question is, you know, 8 years is a short amount of time, but do we feel collectively, and I guess anyone can answer this question, are we better off now in this perspective than we were 8 years ago when it started? I know it was created to raise awareness for this type of stuff. Tom, what do you think?
Yeah, it's hard to say without going out and measuring it.
Sure.
And saying, okay, what's our percentage gain? And I haven't looked at those numbers, but there have been gains, and there certainly is more awareness of people like her. I remember at Tech TV, we were doing stories about Grace Hopper and her work developing COBOL in the U.S. Navy and how she was involved in the people who first popularized bug as a word. And I had never heard of her before. And now she's a household name among tech people. She is much more well known. That's not to say there isn't more to go as far as discovering all the people who have contributed to the development of technology. But even when you talk about people like Alan Turing, he has been rehabilitated and started to get his due. And as that has happened, you start to see other people that worked on his team that he outshone. Right. And so you start to say, well, wait a minute. Turing didn't actually do that. It was his staff member. It was someone who worked on his team. And that's the way a lot of these things happen. You start by just wanting to have that one person because it's easier to wrap your head about. But as that person gets more known, you start to know all the people behind the scenes. And I think that's a good thing that is continuing to happen.
What about you, Baron? Do you think things have changed? I mean, either like in the last 8 years or since you've been covering technology, which might be around the same amount of time.
Yeah, it's one of those things, like you can always look at these markers where you go like, wow, you're like, yeah, there is a difference now. But then you look at some of the diversity reports and you kind of go like, such a long way to go. But, you know, something that I thought about a lot when I was writing the article that I did for CNET was I took a computer class from second to eighth grade. I had a textbook that talked all about folks like, you know, Blaise Pascal and Charles Babbage. And, you know, when I was 8 years old, I could have told you who Charles Babbage was, but Ada Lovelace was not in there at all. I'd like to think that if a textbook was being written today, she would be.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting point because we were talking about technology in schools and, you know, some people in chat room were saying like, I didn't need technology, but like, that's one of the good reasons, like, you know, being able to not just have a textbook that's been around for however long, like I might have used the same textbook that you did in a computer textbook, maybe not. But yeah, it is. That's a good point. So who are some of your role models in tech, Aaron? Like who do you think we should celebrate on Ada Lovelace Day?
Yeah, so Grace Hopper, that was one I think I was telling you before the show, and she's been super top of mind because the Grace Hopper Women in Computing conference or celebration is next week. And just recently, I kind of went back and I was watching this interview that she did with David Letterman in the 80s, where she's brilliant and she's hilarious. And someone a little bit more modern, the president of Harvey Mudd College, Maria Claw. She's done just an immense amount of work to boost the number of not only women at the school, but women in the computer science major, women and minorities, which is super important. And so, you know, whenever you hear that this can't be done, Harvey Mudd is one of those places that you can point to and be like, well, they're doing it. So
right. Yeah. The question of like, well, women don't like engineering. They don't come and apply. But yeah, you look at the statistic of Harvey Mudd and what she's done there, and that's not necessarily true. Well, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us. Aaron Carson is a reporter at CNET. She is at Aaron Carson on Twitter, and so you can see all of her work there. You wrote a couple more articles today beyond just Ada Lovelace. So thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Aaron. Take care. All right, TNT's fan of the day is Michael Gendron on Facebook, who says, this is how I watch TNT using my Microsoft Surface Pro 4. I'm searching for it. It's probably behind the lower third. There we go. All right, cool. So three screens. I'm still looking for like the 8 screen.
Oh, right.
The 9 screen. I don't know. I feel like we keep ramping up the number of screens. So apparently I'm fixated on that. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or a picture of yourself or your setup. Post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT and we will find it.
After the break, emoji are coming to a theater near you. But first, let's take a minute to thank LinkedIn Learning, the sponsor of this episode. The shelf life of skills is less than 5 years, and many of today's fastest growing categories didn't even exist 5 years ago. LinkedIn Learning can help. It's personalized, expert-led, on-demand e-learning from LinkedIn. You can keep your team engaged. LinkedIn Learning is the perfect way to promote professional development. LinkedIn Learning will identify the precise skills that you or your organization need to achieve set goals, and then you can create personalized recommendations using LinkedIn Network Intelligence. LinkedIn will do that for you. Your team will have access to more than 9,000 courses, and more than 25 courses are added every week. Their library includes courses taught by world-class industry experts and cover topics ranging from leadership skills to design principles and programming. Learn anytime, anywhere with their bite-sized segments that can be viewed on any device, online or off. Their bite-sized videos provide immediate problem-solving and can be downloaded to learn on the go. It's a perfect way to help team members close a skills gap without interrupting your latest project. Team solutions are available for as little as $2,000. Grow your network and your career. Visit learning.linkedin.com/twit to request a demo for your organization or get a free individual trial. That's learning.linkedin.com/twit, and we thank LinkedIn Learning for their support of Tech News Today. It is shaping up to be the biggest horror movie of the season, according to some new photos in the Hollywood Reporter. Emoji Movie Express Yourself is, as it sounds, a movie based on emoji come to life. It will star T.J. Miller from Silicon Valley, James Corden from The Late Late Show, and Alana Glazier from Broad City. It's directed by Anthony Leonidas, who is famous for Kronk's New Groove and Lilo and Stitch 2. From reading the premise, I'm giving this movie the sad face emoji or the hands over the eyes emoji, and I really like emoji. Tom, what do you think about the Emoji Movie?
Oh, poor James Corden. Like, really? I love him. He's great. Alana Glazer is pretty great, too. But this sounds like a retread of other plots that have worked in situations that are not this one. And it reminds me quite a bit of Pixels.
I didn't see that one. It really reminds me of Wreck-It Ralph.
The description
actually
does. Yeah. Oh, does it? I didn't see Wreck-It Ralph either.
About all of the game characters kind of uniting for one thing.
I have to say I liked Wreck-It Ralph. It's like a bunch of video game characters in therapy. I was there for this ride, but emoji, no.
Yeah. I mean, at least the poop emoji isn't forgotten, right? It's down there in the corner. That's one positive.
Oh, I thought that was the rating. I'm sorry.
That's a visual representation of the reviews that are expected.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Tom, thank you for joining us on this journey that didn't end well. But
sorry to end it with a poop emoji.
I hate the way they say that the emojis all have faces that can never change their expressions. Like, that's good. That can't make for a good plot.
No.
And they're trying to fix the one emoji who can have different expressions. I'm sorry. I'm going to have a fixed expression about that movie.
Yeah, I'm going to have this Fair expression. But no, I think it's probably just the money face emoji is the one that is, they're probably thinking, mm-hmm. So.
Ching, ching.
Well, Tom, you can check out all of Tom's work at dailytechnewsshow.com. And you don't only do that, you do Sword and Laser. What else do we need to hear about? Is there anything that you would like to tell us that you've
Yeah. Well, Daily Tech Headlines is the newest thing out of my podcasting roundup. If you want to get our daily take on news in less than 10 minutes. But also, I've got a book out on Inkshares called Pilot X. So if you're into science fiction and you'd like a little time travel story, go check it out. You can find out more about that at TomMerrittBooks.com.
Radical. Awesome. And do that. I love it. Thank you, Tom, so much for coming on today. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, well,
it was great having. It was great being here. It was great being had. Wait,
I know it's confusing because you were here, but not here because now we're in a new studio. So, but yeah. There and someone asked in the chat room if you were in the old brick house, and you're not. I mean, as far you I might mean, be.
Well,
actually.
Your house might be a brick house, but it's not the old.
It's got bricks. That's yeah. The otherwise not.
Right. Yeah, that works well.
All right,
thanks
take
again,
care.
Tom. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, guys.
All right, tomorrow's guest is going to be the triumphant return of Ron Richards because you're out.
I am out. I'm recording on location a segment for the Screensavers. It's secret. So, it's secret. Yeah, I can't give you any hints at all, but. Yeah.
Fine. People are just going to have to watch this weekend. I think it's for this weekend, right?
It's for someday, yes.
Okay, someday. And, someday in the near future.
But See? Watch Ron Richards, because that's not a secret. He's amazing.
That's right. That is no secret. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show always by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv. Leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. And find us on Twitter. We're at Tech News Today TV.
Now, you probably already know that you can listen to Tech News Today on your Amazon Echo. You just say, play Tech News Today. And you say also her name, which I won't say because then it would be very confusing. But now we are also available on Amazon Echo's Flash Briefing. So then you get a little short bite-sized version of what we do. And you can get it in the morning or right before you go to bed. Every day you can get updates. The latest tech news from Leo, from Jason, from me. You can hear it by going to the settings in your Alexa app. Search for Twit and subscribe. And you can find, of course, all the ways to subscribe to our longer show at twit.tv/TNT. And if you want to tweet at me, I am at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to our technical director, as always, Kara Cole. Thanks to Burke for scrolling words on a screen for us. We really appreciate it. Kevin for editing and making us look good. And thanks to you for talking tech with us today. And, of course, Tom as well. We'll see y'all tomorrow. Bye, everybody.